Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
The Slaughter Podcast will be discussing topics that some listeners can shove up their butt.
Yeah.
That's what you did last time and it made me laugh.
There we go then.
Right, are you first?
Yes. Hi, everyone.
Hi. Sorry we fucked up last week. I think I just did it all wrong, but...
Yeah, and I can't guarantee that we're not going to fuck it up this week either.
We'll just see what happens.
So... I'm going to start off. I'm going to be telling you the story of Warsop's empty gas meter murder. It doesn't sound any more interesting by giving it a name. No, it really doesn't. But this was taken from a story written in True Detective magazine by Matthew Spicer. So here we go. So in the Nottinghamshire town of Warsop on June the 25th, 1952, is when the story takes place. And that afternoon, after about 2 p.m., residents of Hammerwater Drive were disturbed by sudden screams. A neighbour, who in the story goes by the name of William Smith, but that's not his real name, it's protected, he went to his window to see what was causing the shocking sound, in time to see Mrs. Kathleen Norcliffe stumbling out of her house on the opposite side of the road, covered in blood.
Fuck.
He saw that she was collapsing and he ran from his home without stopping to put on his shoes. And once he reached Mrs. Norcliffe, she was able to say that her husband had beaten her. And so William Smith carried her inside and laid her blood-soaked body onto a mat in the kitchen.
I mean, it's always worth putting your shoes on, I feel.
Because then if you need to do something else after...
Yeah, if you're carrying a person, you want shoes on.
I think it's just testament to how frightening she must have looked. Like, not a little bit of blood. Like, he was like, fuck, I need to get to her right now.
Yeah.
It must be frightening. Another neighbour who had also seen this, she'd gone and phoned an ambulance at the same time. So this Mr. Smith... Obviously, like you said, he didn't have his shoes on, so he wasn't really up for much. So he saw a crew of workmen on the street and like got them to come in to help out because he was just like, what on earth do I do? And he was a young man, and I think he was scared too.
So he wasn't just one of those sort of people going through a bohemian phase where they're like, I don't need shoes anymore. I'm not a part of society. And then they walk around town with bare feet, standing on all the gob on the floor.
Their feet must be really calloused.
Yeah. And I remember there was a person on The Voice a couple of years ago. He's like, I never wear shoes.
Oh, like, there's loads of people like that who've been on X-Ed like, oh, I'm going to perform. I'm going to take my shoes off. You're wearing shoes as you queued to audition. Yeah. Why would you suddenly take them off now? And let's be real. If we want to relax, the first thing you're going to take off is your bra.
Yeah.
So let's not pretend it's your shoes.
That I'm fine with.
Yeah, just don't wear that. Anyway, so he got this crew of workmen to come in and help. And... when they came in, he noticed that there was a trail of blood leading into the living room of the house. So this William Smith entered and found 30-year-old Eric Norcliffe lying on the rug with a deep wound in his left forearm. So a couple of the men, they initially tried to bandage up his wound and help him, but this wasn't enough to stop the bleeding. So they actually resorted to using a tourniquet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, Tom, is that when you have to tie it off really tight so it stops the blood? He's like, yeah, when you're looking for a vein. Yeah. I was like, okay, a sketchy past I don't know about possibly. But he was still alive and and they managed to save him in time. A few hours later, Kathleen Norcliffe's body lay in Mansfield General Hospital, where she was declared dead from multiple stab wounds. Eric Norcliffe was also in this hospital, but he was alive and he was being guarded by a police officer. Those that knew the couple said they'd seemed happy, but it was known that they had money troubles and they were at risk of losing their council house if the rent arrears weren't paid. Eric Norcliffe was unemployed at the time of the incident. He'd most recently been employed as a miner. And previous to that, he'd fought in World War II as a sergeant in the RAF and had been wounded twice while in service. His wife, Kathleen, she'd been younger than him. They married when she was only 18 and she gave birth to three of their children and was still only 23 years old at the time of her death.
Whoa. And she'd had three kids?
Yep.
Well, has she been busy?
I mean, that makes it really sad, doesn't it? Because she was a kid and then married, kids, dead. It's really quite sad. Cut short. The neighbour who'd called the ambulance, again, her name was withheld, so she goes by the name of Mrs. Davis in this article. She stated that Eric Norcliffe had been home all morning of the attack while Kathleen had been out and about running errands. Then Kathleen had returned home at around 1:45, after which the gas meter collector had called round. And not long after he'd left, that's when the screaming began. I think Mrs. Davis had been in her front yard. She was doing washing, beating rugs and things. So she was keeping a close eye on everything that was going on. 2 days after Kathleen's death, Eric Norcliffe was charged with her murder and taken into custody. At the inquest, the cause of death was recorded as shock and hemorrhage due to the stab wounds which had punctured her lungs. And photographs show there were three distinct stab wounds on her back and several others on her arms. I think there are 12 stab wounds in total on her body.
So arm suggests she was fighting someone off then?
Yeah. At Eric Norcliffe's trial then, on the 20th of November of that year, pathologist J.M. Webster testified that two of the stabs in her back had been brought with such force that they'd entered the ribcage, punctured her lungs and caused both sides of her chest to fill up with blood.
Oh my God.
He then went on to say that not only had 23-year-old Kathleen been in good health at the time of her death, it was revealed at the trial that she was also in the early stages of pregnancy with what would have been her fourth child. So then the trial got interesting. So once we got that death out of the way, like such a downer.
Then a clown came in.
But then we get to what was actually going on. So Sergeant Sidney Barlow, he testified in court about the several times following the incident that Eric Norcliffe had implicated himself. So at the crime scene and at the hospital, it was explained to him that his wife was in a critical condition, much worse than his. And both times, Norcliffe's response was just simply, quote, "I wish she'd die."
Whoa. So that's the husband, yeah?
Yes.
Yeah.
So she'd said it was her husband, and then he was like, well, I hope she dies anyway. So they definitely knew it was him. Sergeant Barlow went on to say that when he went to see Norcliffe in hospital and told him that Kathleen's injuries were very serious and that he had reason to believe he was the one that caused them, Sergeant Barlow said that at this point, he cautioned Mr. Norcliffe and reminded him that anything he said would be taken and used against him in evidence. And despite the warning, Norcliffe replied, "Yes, I did it with my sheath knife. We'd been falling out. It'd been going on for some time now. Look after the kids for me."
Whoa, so clear confession.
Yeah, it just was that it.
Yeah.
But it was just saying when he had to remind me of the caution, it reminded me of when I was writing it down, when I was at my very first primary school, back in Barnsley, we had this local policeman, PC Moss, and he just did everything. I don't know if I mentioned, but he did the discos and he came on the residentials and also popped into school to tell us about drugs and stuff.
Shagging a teacher.
I don't know, he just came and did everything. It was a village. But every time I used to see him, I'd be like, "Say the thing from the bill. Say the thing from the bill." And I just wanted him to do the Miranda Rice thing. I don't think I fully knew that it was every policeman said it. I just thought it was made up for the bill. The bill. I was like, they always say the same thing. You say it.
Did he know what you meant?
Yeah. Sometimes he would get annoyed. If it was an assembly, he'd be like, "I'm not doing it now." So this officer, he later returned to Norcliffe. He'd visited the scene and he'd attended the autopsy and he went to inform him of his wife's death. And Northcliffe, he was cautioned once again, but this time he said, "So she's dead. I have nothing to say." As if the other times hadn't counted. Like, well, oh, if it's murder, then I didn't do comment. It. I think that maybe was it. So once he was being interviewed at the station, Northcliffe explained why the attack had coincided so closely with this visit from the man checking the gas meters. Because it was literally, as the neighbour said, a few minutes after he'd come. So back then, and I was reading some of the reviews the other day, and someone was saying how I like listening to the podcast, even though when we're really clueless about things, it makes them feel so old. So I don't know if this is going to be one of those things, but back in the day, Lucy.
I hate when students say that. I'm like, which day? Tell me which day.
Back in 1952.
In the olden days.
On the 25th of June.
Like, the olden days is not a time period you can use in a sociology exam.
You do always say the olden times, as if that's a thing. Around this time, the gas meters would be coin operated. And so you just like put your sixpence in and there'd be a little padlocked section, and part of the gas man's job was to come round, unlock the meter, collect all the coins and check that the amount tallied with your usage. And so the visit of the gas man on the 25th of June in 1952, when he got there, he found that the lock, the padlock on the gas meter, had been broken and all the money from inside was missing. Northcliffe said that this was the first his wife knew of the situation, but it seems likely it didn't take her long to realise the truth, which was that her husband had broken and emptied the meter himself 2 days earlier.
Little shit.
Yes. So, I mean, they've got money problems. He's at home. He's unemployed. He's just taking the money out of the gas meter. He's just getting in more and more of a mess. Yeah. And so now their problems, money problems, are obviously spiralling out of control. This would have led to an argument between the couple. Northcliffe told how he had the knife in his hand, but hadn't intended things to go so far. And then the neighbour, the Mrs. Davis, she testified that she'd heard the gas collector say good afternoon to the couple, followed by Kathleen's voice saying, "Oh, Eric, what are you doing?" After which came the screams that caused her to run round the back to see Mrs. Northcliffe bleeding, and then she ran to another neighbour's house to call the ambulance, because not everyone had a phone in their own house then.
Is that when they had a phone for a number of flats and then they could listen in on each other's conversation?
Oh, like a party line.
Yeah. I love the idea of that. I'd be so tempted.
What film is that where there's a film based on that entire premise, isn't it, with Doris Day, where she every time she tries to get on the phone, there's some like playboy guy who's chatting to girls and she's like, "What is this man?"
I think that's every film she's made. Yeah. What is this man? Oh, I love him.
Yeah, now I'm going to sleep with him. Great. Yeah. But that reminded me, because even though that was the 50s, that was so long ago before when everyone didn't. And I know my mum in the 60s, they didn't have a phone in their house either. But when I worked in the jewellers before going to university, so like 2006, 2005, 2007, around then, one of the rules we had when dealing with customers, if we had to take an order or anything, they'd be like, "One of the questions you must ask them is, are you on the telephone?" I was like, everyone's on the telephone. So I'd be there like, "Oh, what's your telephone number?" And I used to get told off all the time, be like, "No, you should never assume. You should always ask them, are you on the telephone?"
And do you know what I found out the other day though? Luke, when he was at school, teenage years, didn't have a house phone. So he wouldn't have been on the telephone. I mean, he wasn't in a jewellery shop buying jewellery, to be
maybe
fair.
Maybe I'm being really obtuse. So people would... No.
But I said, I was really baffled. And I said, how did people get in touch with you? He said they came round the house.
That's not
without
okay.
Without phoning first.
In the night... No, but like, what about the doctors need to... The school needed to... Because they wouldn't have had mobiles. Yeah. The school would have been trying to ring his mum.
Yeah, he said... Well, they would have been trying to ring his mum. But... He said they couldn't phone his mum. He said they'd save up like who they wanted to phone and then they'd go around his granddad's. And I was like, oh my god, this is so weird. And he was like, it's called poverty, Lucy. I was like, oh shit. That ended that conversation.
Yeah. Now we both feel ashamed. Well, so the defence in this case, they were seeking a verdict of guilty but insane. So they called Eric Northcliffe's father as a witness, and he spoke about how bouts of melancholia, as they said at the time, most likely depression, would take over his son ever since his return from the war. And this had caused some big problems in their marriage before that other people didn't know. There'd been a couple of periods in 1951 and even 1952, earlier that year, where the couple had had to separate and Eric had had to go back and live with his father because he would be suffering from one of these bouts of depression. And his dad said that he would often, during this time, he would find him just sitting for long periods of time, completely unresponsive. A psychiatrist, Dr. Waddis, agreed that Norcliffe did suffer from melancholia, but also temporary amnesia, during which he was unaware of his actions. And this was determined during a 3-hour interview that Waddis had with Norcliffe. And he said that it concluded with a discussion on his thoughts of suicide and, quote, the destruction of the entire family. There'd been no reference made in what I've read about this injury on his own arm previous. I think it's just safe to assume that after stabbing his wife, he'd tried to kill himself. At first, when I read it, I thought maybe this was a defence wound, like where she'd managed to get him with it. But I think after this conversation, it was clear that he would have killed his family and he would have killed himself. And probably explained the candour that he had with the police officers, because he just has a disregard for his own life. And so it didn't really matter if he told them that he did it or not, because he really didn't care what happened to him. The medical officer at Lincoln Prison, where he was being held, he disagreed and testified that in his opinion, Norcliffe was of sound mind. And that seemed to be the deciding voice on it. So the jury found Eric Norcliffe guilty as charged. And when asked if he had anything to say before the sentencing, he said, quote, I've had to keep quiet during the case, but as far as I can see, you've heard how I did it and where I did it, but no one seems bothered about why I did it. Which I think is fair to say. Because when you've got the criminal just like, bye.
Yeah.
But he claimed, he went on, and he said that his wife had triggered this attack because she'd called him a bastard, and that there were more witnesses who could have been called but weren't called. And then there was a little bit of, only a very brief bit of information on Capital Punishment UK, like a blog and website, and they'd told this story, which I think is probably Norcliffe's story. And it was said that it was started that morning, where Kathleen, she was sorting out the kids for school, came down, and Eric hadn't started doing any breakfast. And when she asked him, like, why aren't you doing anything? He was like, well, that's your job to do it. And they had this huge row, understandable, I think. Yeah. Then later she said that she was going out shopping, which angered him because they didn't have money. She was leaving him. They had another huge row. I mean, she was probably just going to get away from him.
Yeah.
Then she came home and was like, it's dinner time, the kids are coming back, couldn't you have started the dinner? And he hadn't, so they had another huge row. This feels very much like my mum and dad. Now that he's retired. Like, if you're going to be home all day, you can't still keep... Like, when my mum wasn't working, was a stay-at-home and my dad worked, yes, she'll do all the cooking, she'll do all the cleaning. But now that you're stay-at-home and she's got a job, she can't still be that person. It's not like it's her job regardless.
That would piss me off if the other half had been home all day and I've got to do the dinner.
Yeah, sort it out. So then he said that they'd had this row about the dinner, so he started chopping some cabbage with his sheath knife, and she apparently criticised his technique of doing so and called him a bastard. So then he just turned around with the knife and... So that's one version of the story. I think it's unlikely, because of the gas man coming and going, that it's more that she'd found him out, I think. She'd found out what he'd done and he'd flipped about it.
Because either way, it's not like his story. It's like, oh, that's totally understandable.
No, it doesn't make any difference for him killing her. But on some level, it is interesting to know about why things happen, what triggered them. But whatever it was, he couldn't handle her being annoyed at him.
Yeah.
For a legitimate reason, it seems. So he, like I say, he was charged guilty and he was sentenced to death. And on the 12th of December in 1952, he was hanged at Lincoln Prison.
I'm surprised that he was hanged, because I feel like I feel like usually there's like a get out, or that it gets dragged on and then people don't get hanged. And
I don't know. I was thinking that why wasn't he in prison for life? Because he was hanged literally the same year as the murder. The murder trial and hanging happened really quickly. But I guess because he was unrepentant, do you think that's what makes the difference to a judge when sentencing? If when they said, do you have anything to say? He'd have said, I was under stress, I was in depression, I wasn't thinking straight, I love my family, I love my kids. Then they'd have done something different.
Where he's like, yeah, what of it? I did it.
He's like, yeah, you don't know why I did it. But it's one of those cases where I think the saddest thing about having a husband and wife situation like that, either way round, is that when there's children then who, not only have you now got a murdered parent, you've now got a
murderer
executed parent. And that's it. You're an orphan, and it's been in this. I think, one of the most horrendous situations.
Better have a nice aunt and uncle, really.
Yeah.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Should I go straight into mine?
Yeah.
Right, this is a bigger, and I'm surprised we haven't already done it. It is Peter Sutcliffe.
I'm surprised we haven't already
done it. I used the book Somebody's Husband, Somebody's Son, by Gordon Byrne for a lot of the information, although near the end I kind of gave up and used some articles because there's so much information.
No, I'm not here to read books.
It took me hours. Like, recognition.
Like, for when it's sloppy and people pick holes, they're like, at least I said I did it for a long time.
Yeah, right. Because the pressure was on, because it's a well-known story, I was like, I can't just give the basics for this one. I've got to look into some detail. So, Peter Sutcliffe was born in June 1946 to his parents, Kathleen and John, who were a Catholic couple. So, he's second born... Oh no, he's firstborn, but obviously because they're a Catholic couple, they're going to have like a million more kids. He was very sickly as a child, and his sibling died. He spent a lot of time with his mum, and they were super close, a bit weirdly close, very much a mummy's boy, bit of a loner, preferred staying in with his mum. And then even when he was a bit older, he'd still hang out with his mum, or he'd be like reading, but he didn't like playing out. And his father was very much like a man's man and thought this was really weird. He was bullied a bit at school. He coped with that with hiding away. And in the playground, he'd go stand in a corner in this little spot where he could see what everyone was doing, but then people couldn't really see him. And his dad used to walk past the school or just like give him a wave, and then you'd see like his kid like just standing in the corner with these little weird beady eyes looking around. And I think he was like, yeah, my kid's weird.
That's really sad. Can you imagine it being at school and there was just a kid who every break would just stand on the corner on their own?
Almost as bad as singing to yourself. That's what I used to do only at infants. Then I got a friend at primary.
I remember when I would walk home from secondary, I'd have headphones in and I would mouth along to the songs, just to enjoy myself. And I was like, oh, it'll be fine because people will think that I'm talking on a Bluetooth or something. It'll be to your call. And then one of the girls in my ear was like, I saw you singing on the way home. And I was like, but I wasn't making a noise.
See, I used to flat out talk to myself on the way home. And I just, because I was a naive teenager, I just assumed that no one in cars looked at people walking.
Yes, that's why I was like, I was like, no one will see me walking along.
I was like, I can't see anyone. Yeah, I can't see anyone walking towards me. Therefore, I'm safe. And then my friend and her dad, he used to give her a lift home and they used to drive past me. And then whenever I saw her dad, he's like, oh, it's the little storyteller. And I was like, what? Well, you used to podcast to myself on the way home. Like preparation. I find those
teenagery awkward things so weird because the embarrassment is so deep that you remember them like now for years and years and years. Like I've done loads of idiotic stuff as a teacher, but it never cuts you as deep as when you're that age and you're like, I've been found out. They know I'm a weirdo.
But then what I find weird is the amount of kids at school who do weird stuff all the time and really don't seem to give a shit. Whereas I was quiet and there's kids that shout out stupid stuff and everyone laughs at them and I would have absolutely died, but they just don't care. They just shout out something else like 2 minutes later.
Yeah.
It's weird. But thinking of that, the weirdest thing happened in my class today. I was teaching a citizenship lesson and they had to do about the police powers and they had, I didn't plan the lesson, it was just done. And they had arrest and detain was one of them, stop and search was one of them, and then there was another one. And this kid, and they had to present in pairs or on their own to the group about their thingy, about the one that they had. And this kid, year seven, a bit strange, and he like puts his face really near you when he talks to you, so he's a bit strange already. And he had one and it had like a bit about how police aren't allowed to strip search you in public, which is a bit weird that we're doing about that, but fine.
Yeah, what year was this that they have to learn this?
Year seven.
I'm like, so when you get arrested, kids, here's how to stand up to the police.
Exactly. So then he was like, can I use volunteers in my presentation? And I said, yeah, if it's acceptable. So then when we got to presenting time, he puts his hand up, he wants to present. So I get him up and he gets up and says, the police have lots of different powers. They are allowed to search you. However, they're not allowed to strip search you in public. Can I have a volunteer, please? And all the kids were like, what the... looked at each other.
Like, is he going to try and rip my clothes off?
Then I'm looking at the kids and looking at him. And then this one girl, a girl at the back and then a boy at the front put their hands up and he goes running over to the girl at the back and puts his face really near hers because that's how he talks to people and goes, yeah, come on up. And she's like, I don't want to do it anymore. So then I get one of the boys to go up who wanted to go up anyway. I love
that you're just like, rather than saying, what are you going to do with him? Like, I'm going to see how this plays out.
That's exactly what I said to the kids. I said, let's just see how this plays out, guys. And I said, just be careful. And then... So all he wanted...
Just be careful.
All he wanted the kid to do was to pretend to stab someone and then he was going to tell him to go back to the station. But it was so strange. Well, we're going to have to see what happened.
We can't live with the not knowing.
Exactly. So anyway, so little Peter Sutcliffe is...
also a weird kid.
Being a bit of a voyeur in the playground. So he left school age 15 and he went straight to work at an engineering works as an apprentice. But he remained painfully shy and... I've gone to see kids on work experience in situations like that. And if they can't engage with other members of staff, people, I guess, sort of ignore them or, like, find them a bit strange. And it annoys people when people are quiet at work, I feel. But when you're that age, you just don't know how to respond. You've just not got the social skills yet. So he didn't make much of an impression on others, mostly went unnoticed. At home, he spent a lot of time just either staring into space or he'd go into the bathroom for hours and hours on end.
Yeah. What, at home?
Yeah.
I thought you meant on work experience because, like, I've definitely hid in the toilets on work experience before. Like, in lunch hour, that's a really long time when you don't know anyone and don't know what to say. You'd be like, oh, just hide here.
Particularly in schools because they get so many people in and out, they do not give one shit about a newbie.
Yeah, when I worked on supply for a bit, I'd be like, I'm just going to stay in this classroom for the entire day. I didn't even go to wee. Like, I did not dare leave that room. I was like, this is the room that I'm in for the next 6 hours and no one can speak to me.
No one likes a supply teacher. That's the problem. So, I mean, he was 17 and he had four brothers and sisters. So I'm guessing he didn't have his own room. So he had to go somewhere. Apparently, he would just also, like, do other stuff in there. Like, he'd just sort of sit and stand and, like, stare at himself in the mirror just for ages. And
it was, like, the 60s, wasn't it?
Though, zone out. I mean, there's no phone to play on. I guess there's not even like games consoles or stuff.
So, I always think that on TV, like when you're watching a period film, like people just sit in rooms. They just sit and have a think.
Yeah, just contemplate. Write letters.
Yeah.
A lot of that. He quit his job because he didn't like it, and he had another of like several low-paid manual jobs as well. After, for a while, he was a grave digger as well, and he began to gain a little bit more confidence. And he saved up and he bought a motorbike. And I guess that was sort of like, this is my personality now. I have a motorbike. So he began spending time outside. He'd stand outside the house, fiddling around with his motorbike, looking sort of like he's repairing it, even though he didn't really know what he was doing. And he made a few male friends, pretty quiet like himself, but people to sort of knock about with, and they'd go for drives. They didn't really like going out locally to the pubs and things, and it was quite a small town. So they'd go off, and then they started, I mean, they were all right looking, so they started getting a bit of attention from girls, but Peter Sutcliffe didn't really seem very interested in that, but he was happy to sort of tag along with his friends when they were hanging out with girls and things. Peter met Sonia Suzama, who was Czechoslovakian. She had Czechoslovakian parents. Is it Czech Republic now?
Yes.
And they started quite an intense relationship. She drank in bars and pubs at age 16. So, I think you could just get away with it in small towns, really, a little bit more. And obviously in the 60s. So,
yeah.
But she was also really shy. His parents initially liked her. Well, they were just really excited that he wasn't gay.
I guess, like, he's finally doing normal things.
Yeah. But then they quickly found her really boring and not really much personality or motivation.
Like, you can move in your girlfriend, but we're gonna want her to entertain us.
Yeah, well, they were just, you know, when people are so shy that it feels like they're just being rude because they're not making any effort, but they just can't. I think it was a bit like that. So then Peter's brother Mick came home one day and he told Peter that he'd seen Sonia in a sports car with another man.
Dun, dun, dun.
And then Peter made no response. Now, he wasn't someone to lose his temper quickly anyway. He was really quite reserved and controlled, but it did play on his mind a lot. And he confronted her and she said it was true. She'd started studying at a local college and he was an Italian with a sports car. So she'd started cheating, basically, and she didn't really say she was going to break up with him, but she also didn't say she was going to break up with Peter Sutcliffe. So this went on for a bit of time. So in response to this,
they formed a throuple.
He started shagging sex workers. So he started driving to Bradford. He had a car by this point, and he started hiring sex workers in his car. But he initially, he sort of just saw them as like a commodity, but then he started to hate them. And it's because of one experience where there was a sex worker who he'd agreed a price with, but he only had a £10 note and she'd said it would be £5. So she said, oh, I'll just go in his garage to get change, and went in with his £10 note. And then these two men came in and chased him away, and she just kept the tenner. So he was furious and he thought she was a foul woman. He developed a loathing for any prostitute, he said in his words. So around this time, 1969, age 23, he also told a friend that he'd started carrying a sock around in his pocket.
Full of coins.
No, but
whacking.
Yeah, it was for whacking.
Oh, what was it? What was in it?
He didn't have anything in it, but he said if he needed to.
What's the fucking point? He's just going to, like, tickle them to death.
Well, he said he's just going to
wave his smelly sock in people's faces. That, to be fair, that would weird people out. It's like that video on YouTube where it's like how to get out of any fight and the guy just goes up and, like, pulls his trousers down. And then everyone freaks out because they're like, having a fight is easier for them than being around a homosexual, apparently.
What?
I mean, there's like loads of videos like that on YouTube where it's like, oh, if someone starts beating you, just enjoy it and just be like, oh yeah, harder, harder. And then it freaks people out.
Yeah, Carl Pilkington on the Ricky Gervais podcast said that a guy, I think I might have said this before, Yeah, I think I've said it before, where a guy came over and tried to steal his shoes and he just started going, yeah, you want my shoes? Well, I paid a lot for these shoes. I love these shoes. And just started being really weird and freaked him out and the guy just ran off.
Yeah.
I think it works. But no, he said that if he needed to, he could pick up a rock and then put it in the sock.
There's not always a rock about.
Well, I think he's thinking of if I need to feel like attacking someone, whereas then...
Oh, not if as I in like in the heat attacked. Of the moment. Well, then why don't you just find a good rock and have it ready?
Well, he
I don't like this plan. I think he just had a sock in his pocket. Do you know, like, if I, like, when you were a kid, did you ever go to school? Why? What's this in my trouser leg? This happened to me in assembly once when I was about 7.
Are you going to say dirty knickers?
Yeah. Pulled a pair of pants out of the bottom of my leggings when I was, like, 7.
Did anyone see?
I don't remember anyone seeing. I was like, oh, that's what it is. That's what that is. But maybe that's what happened. It was like he pulled it out of his trouser leg one day and someone was like, ew, is that a dirty sock you've left in your trousers? And he's like, no, this is my whacking sock. I'm just waiting to find a really good rock and then I'm going to get
you. Yeah, I bet. Yeah, probably. He also said that to his friend that he'd recently done that, like put a rock in the sock and he'd whacked a sex worker he'd described as an old crone on the back of the head with it. It turned out to be true because she went to the police and the police came and questioned him. But he said, I did whack her, but I just whacked her with my hand. And so they let him go.
You're allowed to just smack people on the back of the head and that's fine.
Apparently. In September of the same year, he was arrested after he'd been seen crouched in a garden holding a hammer and a policeman had walked past and been like, that's weird. And he was charged with being equipped for theft, which he was all right with because... I guess he knew he was equipped for murder, effectively. So he goes, hammer is his weapon of choice from now
on. So he's like, oh, theft. Yep, that's me.
Yeah. So after 6 months of seeing the Italian, Sonia finally promises that she's going to end it. So he begins visiting her at college every weekend where she's staying. And she was studying art. So she goes like, she's quite an arty type after a bit. But in 1972... she's admitted to a psychiatric hospital after she, in the middle of the night, started wandering the streets in her pyjamas, convinced that the world was going to end because of something like technology taking over. So her parents stepped in and they said to Sutcliffe, you need to stay away for a while they care for her. So she did improve a bit and then she relapsed because she believed that she was Cinderella. So Sutcliffe now has got more time and more independence. So he begins visiting sex workers all the more. Then he gets a job working nights though. So that ends his visiting of the sex workers. So then he begins to dedicate time to nursing Sonia back to health, which impressed her parents quite a lot. They thought this guy, you know, he stuck around. And it took 4 years. And as far as they knew, he was loyal that whole time. So they're kind of like, look, this guy's proved himself. So then they get married.
He stuck around when she was dating another man for 6 months.
Yeah, true.
He was obviously just going to cling no matter what.
Yeah. So they get married on Sonia's 24th birthday and then the two of them move in with her parents and they go on honeymoon in Paris.
It does seem all very much, I mean, I guess it's from his point of view, but I feel like she doesn't seem to have any authority in what's happening. She's like trying to date another guy. He's still apparently her boyfriend. Ugh, fine. Months later. Then she's like having an episode and he's just stepping in to care for her. And then it's like married. Like, I'm not seeing much agency on her part in it.
I mean, things got worse after they got married. So, but I think, to be honest, a lot of it was from her side. So Sonia had like quite a quick temper when they lived together. So they lived in her parents' house in a room and... there was no plans to move out. I think they were saving money to buy their own place. Obviously, he was working quite menial jobs. She was studying. But she got into arguments with Peter Sutcliffe quite a lot. But she also got into arguments with her parents. And those three sort of got along well. He got along with his in-laws pretty well. So she was sort of barraging people with argumentative behaviour. Maybe she just wasn't happy and she didn't know what to do about it. But he would respond by spending hours in the bathroom again. So in 1975... Sutcliffe began to take an interest in a divorcee, early 30s, called Anna Rogulski. He approached her in public when he first saw her, asking her to come over for a coffee, but she refused. Now, this is the first time that he's gone down this predatory road or been... It seems like he just went from nothing, whacking that woman... nothing, and then this really escalates. So then he follows her after he's asked her for a coffee, but seems to give up, so she doesn't think more about it. Now, she lives with her boyfriend. They have a row one night, and she goes out, she walks off to the police station to report him being abusive to her. And then after leaving the police station, Sutcliffe approaches her in an alley, asking if she fancied it. She responded, "Not on your life." And then he followed her and hit her from behind 3 times over the head with a hammer. Then he pulls out a knife with the intention of killing her. He raises her blouse and he's about to stab her in the stomach when a man shouts, "What's going on out there?" And he runs off. Now, the man had obviously seen that something was going on, but she passes out and she's left there for an hour. So he obviously kind of went, "Guy's gone, I don't need to worry about it." And then she's taken to hospital, and luckily she did then, because she had a 12-hour operation which saved her life, but she couldn't describe her attacker.
My God.
She couldn't remember what he looked like at all. So the very first attack, obviously intended to be murder, there's not really much escalation here. And then he sticks with this hammer and the knife business for the entirety of his attacks. So the same year, Sutcliffe was out with a friend called Trevor Birdsall, and they were driving home from the pub when Sutcliffe saw an older woman, 46-year-old office cleaner Olive Smelt, who he is convinced is a sex worker. So he pulls over, and they'd seen her earlier the night, and he says, "We saw her earlier, she's a sex worker, I'll be right back." Follows her down an alleyway, hits her twice on the head with a hammer, then goes back to the car with his mate and drives off. Which, really, really strange, erratic behaviour.
Yeah, because if he's just doing it for fun, he's not stuck around to enjoy it. He's like, "Oh, I'm just really going to quickly do something."
Yeah. But then, like, his friend Trevor sees an article the next day about a woman who's been hit in the head by a hammer. He obviously knows that it was Sutcliffe.
Because, oh, he knows it was him.
Yeah. But because of the area, so this area, Bingley, this area in Yorkshire, violence against women was just so commonplace.
Everyone is just carrying hammers around.
Well, but Trevor's beating up his wife. I mean, he's a bit like, well, this is what we do. Just people are just beating up their wives left, right and centre, and it's just accepted. So he was just like, oh, well, it's just another woman getting hit by a man. So he doesn't say anything. So that summer, Sutcliffe gains a position as a long distance lorry driver, which is a very dangerous job for someone who is out to murder people. And there is, I think, did you say that you watched that program? I gave up on it eventually, but it was about how long distance lorry drivers and sex workers, there's often a lot of hiring of sex workers by people who are traveling long distance.
Yeah.
So I think there were women around that were offering themselves.
Yeah, because there was... Oh, God, why is my memory so bad? Because we talked about the documentary loads, didn't we?
Yeah.
And about how there were so many missing sex workers on this particular stretch of highway. So they were, like, suspected that it would be a long-distance drivers because...
Yeah.
And it's so hard to catch them because, like...
Yeah, because then they're gone.
It's so random.
So October 29th, 1975.
I meant random as in like random attacks, not like that's not my observation.
Oh my God, that's so random.
So random.
So October 29th, 1975 in Leeds, Wilma McCann, a housewife, had been to the pub. Now she got curry and chips on the way home.
Yes.
Yeah, funny. And she didn't feel like walking, so she flagged down a lift. Now she's picked up by Peter Sutcliffe. Now Sutcliffe had said that she offered him sex for £5 and they pulled over. He said, yeah. But that because he didn't get immediately erect, that
she's got a gob full of curry sauce.
Yeah.
Sorry, she's going to get murdered. She's in gob full.
So she got annoyed, apparently, and stormed off. I think she said something like, well, if it's going to take you that long, I'm not bothered anymore, and got out.
Fair enough.
Yeah. I mean, she was sorry. She wants to get it over with and go home. Like,
yeah, give me £5 for a taxi because you're weird.
So then... he follows her. She walks off. He gets his hammer out. He hits her repeatedly over the head. He stabs her. Then he drives home and goes to bed. I think he... like, I don't think he had blood on his clothes. Obviously, he's living with his in-laws as well. No one suspects anything. No one sees anything.
He must have done. If you hammer somebody, there's going to be blood spatter. You have to be really close range with somebody to do that. And it's such a violent and brutal thing. Like,
He must have, yeah. So Wilma's body is found the next day and she's been stabbed 9 times. But there's no one linked to the murder. It's such a random thing that he's just picked her up. It's not like there's any... if you look at all the people she knows, it's never going to be him, is it? So then Sutcliffe's next victim was a middle-aged woman who's happily married. She's got three children and worked at her husband's roofing business, but times are really hard. She's called Emily Jackson. And she was also, when her husband went to the pub, she was working as a sex worker just to make some extra money in the evenings. So she was picked up by Sutcliffe, who had asked her to help him. So they drive off and he says, the engine's making a funny noise. Can you help me have a look at it? They pull over. She walks round. As she's looking at the engine, he hits her on the back of the head with a hammer and then he stabs her 52 times with a screwdriver. It's totally violent. He doesn't have sex with these women. He just, it's like he's obviously getting off on the murder. Are you trying to?
I'm trying to see how long it would take to 52 stabs. I'm only on 30 right now. Like
it's horrific. So again, no links to him, body's found, no one knows anything. So then a month later, I mean, this is a lot of women in a very short amount of time. This is why he's known as, I'd say, UK's worst serial killer.
I suppose it's like, I suppose with a lot of these, like once you've got away with them, and you're like, yeah, well, keep going.
Exactly. So a month later, he attacks Marcella Claxton, a black sex worker. He hits her twice with a hammer, but she survives. She needs 50 stitches to her head. Now, she had learning difficulties, so although she gave a bit of an account of the attack, people basically really ignored it. And people weren't, at this point, piecing together that these attacks were connected, because sex workers were getting attacked a lot anyway. Yeah,
just the general thing of like, yeah, oh well, you're putting yourself in that position, people are gonna act like that towards you.
Yeah, so he gets worried then, because he thinks she didn't die, she might be able to say what I look like. So he gives it a few months then, but Marcella didn't lead the police to him. She didn't know enough about him, so no one comes for him, so he continues.
Well, also, it's hitting people in the head, so yeah, when you've had a serious head injury, I don't think your memory is going to be crystal clear usually.
So he attacked Irene Richardson, which is a homeless sex worker, hit her over the head with a hammer while she was having a wee, and her body was found near to Jimmy Savile's house. Add it to the little slaughter killer map. So by now, the media had been publishing so many of these attacks and murders that it was realised that these were connected, and the name the Yorkshire Ripper had begun to be used in the papers. But Sutcliffe was nowhere near to be being caught at this point. There's a lot to go. Sex workers had begun to work in teams, and they twigged on it's not safe. Or a lot of them were moving from the Yorkshire area and going to work in Manchester because it was considered that was more safe. So Tina Atkinson, she was a sex worker, and she worked on one of the busiest roads in Yorkshire, but because it was so busy and there were a lot of women there and obviously they were working in teams, she just didn't fancy it that night. She went off to the pub and then she got really drunk. They refused to serve her, so then she started approaching men in the car park, which was obviously a dangerous way to go, but I think she thought, what are the odds that this guy they're looking for is here? So then she gets into Sutcliffe's car and they drive away. They went to her flat, where he killed her with a hammer and then used the knife again. And he left her body in the flat, but he threw the hammer from his car while he was driving home.
So he's buying new hammers every time.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if this is...
Then this is an open and shut case. Just be like, go down to B&Q. Who's your main hammer customer? Yeah. That's a very expensive way to do things.
But this hammer gets found, but it's found by a groundsman who just uses it for the next 3 years as his best hammer.
Saw that line in your book before you said it, just be like, ooh,
free hammer, lovely.
He'll be covered in blood.
I know, there's got to be some evidence on it.
That just shows you how expensive hammers are. Yeah, that he's willing to use this bloody murder weapon that it's clearly been used in a murder. Yeah, that he's going to use it as his best hammer.
To the side of the road.
Because I can't be just throwing away hammers willy-nilly. I can beat a Sutcliffe, he doesn't give a shit.
So next, Sutcliffe broke from his pattern and he targeted a 16-year-old girl who was not a sex worker, Jane McDonald. She'd been out with friends. She'd met a boy when she was out who was 18. Had a bit of a cheeky snog with him. He'd walked her partway home. They'd said, oh, let's go for a date next week. Then she walked the rest of the way home. It was quite a nice night. And spotting her, Sutcliffe had followed her. And then he'd just hit her from behind at an opportune moment. And then he dragged her into a playground And she was murdered. But the media described her as the first innocent victim of the Yorkshire Ripper, which really shows the mentality that people had of sort of like, oh, now we've got to take it seriously.
Well, because if saying she's the first innocent victim, then what's the implication that the others are guilty? Yeah. Like that they... That's really bad.
Like brought it on this out. Awful.
That they're criminals too is basically what they're saying. And it doesn't really... That's horrendous.
So his next victim was 42-year-old Maureen Long, who she was quite known in the area. She'd been working as a sex worker for quite a long time, but also she went to the pubs a lot. She'd been picked up for sex. She'd gone for a wee and he'd struck her on the head with a hammer, then stabbed her. And he left her there on some wasteland. Now, she survived. And this time, someone had seen them as well. They'd seen her get out of the car. They'd seen the car. But they were mistaken about the make of the car. They were really similar. They said it was a white Ford Cortina, but he had a white Ford Corsair. So then the police were just looking for a white Ford Cortina because this witness had been quite sure. And they were stopping cars and questioning people. Obviously they didn't find him. So the same year, Sutcliffe picked up Jean Jordan, who was a 20-year-old sex worker and in Manchester. So he's broadened out now at this point, and he's even targeting women in Manchester, I guess because the others are working in teams and he's just like, I'll just go where it's easy. So they agreed a price and they went into some wasteland where he hit her with a hammer 11 times and then he hid her body and left. Now, her body was found by Bruce Jones, who played Les Battersby in Coronation Street.
No way!
But they're all over Manchester, Coronation Street actors.
True.
Like, if you turn a corner, there's a Coronation Street actor. While driving home, Sutcliffe had realised that he'd given Jean a £5 note for the sex transaction.
Oh, and was like, I'm going to get that back.
Well, he hadn't got it back off her, but then he realised that he'd got that from work and it was a brand new £5 note and they could trace... like the mark on it to see where it
came like
from.
The little serial numbers and shit.
Yeah. So a few days later, he kept checking the papers to see if Jean had been mentioned in there because then he'd know that they'd found the body and no one had said anything. So he went back to the body and he searched and he couldn't find the £5 note anywhere. He thought it's not in her pockets. He tried to look for a handbag. He couldn't find one. And then angrily, he's like mutilated the body.
So somebody's taken the £5 note? Well, or do you think it was just lost in the kerfuffle?
Just wait, you'll find out.
Oh, okay.
So 10th of October, Jean's body's found, and then a few days later they find her handbag, or a purse for American listeners, and in there is the £5 note. Ooh. Now police have the same thinking that he had and they say, right, we're going to trace this. Now a lot of people were quite they were like, well, look, £5 notes get handed around all the time. This is nonsense. You don't even know who gave it to her. It could be anyone. But the police decided, look, this is the best lead we've got. We're going to find out where that £5 note came from. And they worked out that it was a batch that had been handed out to some factories in the Yorkshire area. So one of the men they questioned as a result was Peter Sutcliffe. And he said that he'd been home the night of the murder, which his wife also confirmed.
Oh,
I know.
Sonia.
Yeah. Then they questioned loads of men. He wasn't top suspect or anything like that. They questioned a lot of people. 14th December, Sutcliffe was out driving and he sees Marilyn Moore, who's a 25-year-old sex worker. And he sees that she refuses to get into a car with a man because she's only seeing her regulars at this point just to be safe. So he parks his car a little bit out of sight, jumps out, and then shouts, bye, see you later, as if he's like leaving one of the local buildings. And this is enough for her to think, he seems safe enough, I know where he works. And she gets in the car with him. So he's quite clever. So he pulls over and suggests that they have sex in the back of the car. So as she gets out to get in the back of the car, he hits her. And he sort of misses and slips in the mud. So then he hits her again twice, but she obviously has felt it at this time. The first blow wasn't as strong as normally it would have been. So she's screaming and screaming and screaming, does exactly the right thing. And some people not far away look over and he notices them. So he goes, so she survives this attack. And she was able to give police a description of Sutcliffe. So they draw the sketch and they've got something to go on then.
Interesting, on the Facebook group this week, there's been a conversation about someone brought up why... people's female friends seem to be more into true crime than male ones. There's a bit of a discussion about it. And a few, loads and loads of people, I think we've probably said it before, talking about the fact that they're into it because it's like, there's always little tips for how to stay safe a little bit. So there's one for you. Just scream a lot.
Yeah.
Get people's attention.
Exactly. Despite the fact they've now got a description of him, Sutcliffe still continues and he attacks sex worker Yvonne Pearson. So after he'd hit her, a car pulls up nearby and they're in a bit of wasteland. He often does this. I think the women tend to agree, like, oh, we'll pull over, we'll have sex in this wasteland and then you'll take me back to the street where I got into the car. So a car pulls up right next to them. So while he's attacking her, he grabs her, pulls her down and grabs some stuffing from an abandoned sofa. And there used to be stuff with horse hair, like actual horse's hair. Right. And he grabs a handful out and he shoves it in her mouth so she can't scream and then holds her nose. Which, imagine how rat, like, it's moldy old sofa. And then he just holds her down for like what could have been, he said, up to an hour. Just her there, knowing that she's with this guy who's obviously the Yorkshire Ripper and she can't scream, he's got her. And then eventually this car just pulls away and he beats her to death. And then he puts her body under the sofa and it's not found for months. So tragic. And then he carries on. 10 days after that murder, he approaches Helen Ritke.
He just thinks he's invincible, doesn't he?
At Huddersfield Market, and he convinces her to go for a quickie over at the timber yard. I'm surprised that he's... I don't know if there's a lot of women who are willing to have sex with him for money, or he can pick out a sex worker in a crowd.
And I was thinking that. I was like, I didn't realise there were that many people, but I guess he's looking for them, isn't he?
Yeah.
Also, I'm really shocked at the places where they're going. We've had wasteland, timber yard. I thought... I don't know.
Yeah, ooh. quite built up areas. Pub car park.
Not a building.
Yeah. So he planned to hit her. Then he realised this time he's got an erection. So it goes to show that he's not usually sexually excited, but I don't understand the mentality.
Twisted.
So he still gets out of the car and he hits her and then... He realises that two taxis not far away can see them. So then he drags her into a corner and he rapes her and then he stabs her. And then he hides her body behind some wood. Like another horrific, awful crime. And then her sister reports that her missing 3 days later. I don't know why it took her 3 days. I think she was scared. Or wondered, like...
Well, if you don't like... I don't know. I think it would... That's reasonable, I think.
Well, she'd literally been at the market with her, though.
Okay. Yeah. But if you just assume they've gone home or something, it's not you've got a mobile to check, you'd easily go 3 days without chatting to someone.
So then sniffer dogs very quickly find her body in this nearby yard. And then that's seven victims now. So the Yorkshire Ripper, huge news story. And there's a Radio 2 show that was really popular with a lot of young women called The Jimmy Young Show. And they put on their radio show... You know, if you know women out there, if you know a man who's been a bit odd, report it. Look, we've got to get this guy. It could be. And I think that's why the name of this book is Someone's Husband, Someone's Son. Because they're like, it could be someone that you know. This is someone who's got a normal life. So women did start to come forward, but not Sonia. So, and then the Yorkshire Post offer £5,000 reward for any information that leads to a conviction. People are getting desperate now. So for 2 months, the killing...
I'm getting desperate now.
I know, it's long. So for 2 months, the killing went quiet. And then he murders Vera Millward, aged 40. And she was killed in the Manchester Royal Infirmary car park. And then he stops for a year. And during this time, his mother dies. So I think that's probably why. So the police... I mean, a lot of people have been...
I mean,
very
I'm sure she was okay, but I'm finding it hard to give a shit about his mum dying.
I get it. The police heavily criticised. I mean, what are they doing all this time? I guess they've got no leads, but there must have been some evidence anywhere. I mean, they have questioned him as well. I mean, I don't know. But
there's no DNA. He had an alibi.
I mean, they know blood type.
They might not even be connecting all of them for a really long time.
Yeah. So then the assistant chief constable received letters from... someone who signs off Jack the Ripper.
Oh, here we go.
With details of the murders. which at first they're like, no, no, no. But then there's information in these letters that they feel like no one else could have known. Shortly after that, Josephine Whittaker, a 19-year-old bank clerk, is assaulted walking home. And again, media storm, another innocent victim. Police follow a lead of a tape recording of a man with a Sunderland accent. So they start looking for someone, Sunderland accent, which had this guy talking on it, saying, I am the murderer, I'm the Yorkshire Ripper, I did it. But this turns out to be some alcoholic guy from Sunderland who wanted a bit of publicity. And he gets charged with...
That's so weird that an innocent person would be like, yeah, I'll just tell them I'm the one.
I guess, like, it's such a sensation that people who are a little bit in need of some attention might come forward. We've had...
I guess. But, like, he's not, like, going to the police. He's just, like, mouthing off, being like, yeah, it's me, I kill women.
Yeah. Well, he sent it to the police, though.
Oh.
Yeah. Like,
oh,
a tape recording. So, Sutcliffe murdered another non-sex worker, who's 20-year-old student, Barbara Leach. He's re-interviewed by the police regarding the £5 note, like asking for alibis, but they're not really gaining any insight. He's nowhere near top of the list. He's just another guy. And his wife, I guess,
is covering for
him.
I wonder what his job performance is like.
I wondered that, because...
Like, surely all these murders take a toll on a person. Well, like, how can you have a normal conversation anymore?
Yeah.
Like, what do you chat about when you're out hammering people every night?
Well, I guess he's a lorry driver, so he's not chatting to anyone about anything, that's really. True. So Sutcliffe is then arrested for driving while drunk. And then, so they let him go, awaiting trial for that. He continues to murder. He killed Marguerite Wells, age 47, in August 1908. Jacqueline Hall in November the same year. He also attacks Upadhyaya Bhandara in Leeds. She survives. And Teresa Sykes in Huddersfield, and she survives. So widespread, these assaults, murders are happening. And at this time, one of Sutcliffe's friends actually goes to the police and says, I think Peter Sutcliffe is a good option for you to investigate.
But, so he must have been creepy in his day-to-day life then. If your friends can get to the point where they're like, I think he's probably a murderer. Like, what would you have to start doing for me to be like, oh, I think Lucy is killing people? You'd have to be fucking weird. He must be dropping bombs.
Yeah, like maybe saying something weird about how he doesn't like sex workers and then...
Yeah.
But then the information's just lost. They didn't follow it up.
What?
I know. Ridiculous. So, 1981, this is how they get him.
Okay, we're there.
We're there. No more murders from this point on.
Everyone just switches up.
He picks up 24-year-old sex worker Olivia Reavers. And the police at this point think, look, the best option we've got for finding someone who's murdering sex workers is finding people who've got a sex worker in their car and then, I guess, asking them if they're going to murder them. So they stop him. They then run his number plates of the car and they are false. And they obviously think, white car, relevant. And then they look at him and they think, looks a bit similar to the drawings that we've had from other victims. So they take him in for questioning. Before that, he goes for a wee while the police are sort of running the plates and
chucks
stuff.
Chucks his hammer out the window.
Exactly.
Oh my God, did he literally?
Yeah. And then he's arrested. So police go back to the spot where they arrested him the next day. I guess they're like, oh yeah, we probably should check that. They find a hammer, a rope and a knife that he's just cast to the side, which I don't know how he hid those so well.
It's like that scene on The American Office where Dwight's getting pulled over by the police, so he's just like quickly throwing all these weapons out of the window before they come.
Yeah. And he also hid a second knife in the cistern of the toilet at the police station before he was searched as well. Now, the weirdest thing is that when they ask him to take off his clothes in the station...
You cannot force me to do a strip search. I learned this in year 7 English or whatever.
Not in public, but you can in the station. But he's got a jumper under his clothes. But not, he's not wearing a jumper like I'm wearing a jumper right now. He's put his legs through the armholes... And his little gonads are dangling through the neck hole of this jumper.
Do you think it's like he just needed a pair of long johns and was like, this will have to do?
What, with his knob out?
I don't know.
Air it out. Can get quite sweaty. I don't know, but I mean, if you're strip searching someone, I think that'd that's be, number if I one was alarm the police bells. Officer
finding that, my first question would be why.
Yeah,
that needs to have been written down
exactly. So he's questioned itch,
like with underwear on. No balls actually, like yeah. They were hanging out. So literally. That was his underwear.
Yeah,
was a jumper.
So they're like, this guy is a murderer. I mean, yeah. I mean, you would, wouldn't you? So he's questioned intensely for 2 days, and eventually he admits that he is the Ripper, and he says that God had told him to murder the women. And I guess he's got this sort of like idea of like, I'm ridding the world of. But then he's murdered loads of women who like desperate situations, or they're doing it for their family. And I guess he didn't think of that at the time, but it's so obvious. And then also he's murdered women that aren't sex workers as well. And I just, it's just so deluded. But he says that he is not guilty to the 13 counts of murder that he's being charged with, because he says it's diminished responsibility because he has paranoid schizophrenia. And 4 psychiatrists agree that he has got paranoid schizophrenia.
Oh, fuck.
So the prosecution say, right, we're going to accept his plea on manslaughter. But the judge says, fuck no, this guy is going to trial, basically. I mean, he was keeping a job. It's not like he's mindlessly going around. He held that woman down and put horsehair in her mouth so she couldn't scream for an hour. I mean, this is planned out. It's not like he didn't understand that he couldn't do it. So he goes to trial. He's found guilty. He gets minimum 30 years for 13 murders. I think that's pretty light. So he'd be about 65 when he gets out. So Sutcliffe was initially kept at Pankhurst Prison, but despite him not being able to stand trial, he is categorised as, I guess, insane, and he's sent to Broadmoor. Now, at the prison, he's attacked by prisoner James Costello. Then at Broadmoor, he's attacked by Kenneth Erskine.
Oh, you did him!
Stockwell Strangler.
I sounded a bit too happy to recognise him.
Kenneth!
How have you been? How's Broadmoor treating you?
Great. And then he's also attacked by a Jamie Devitt, and then like a load of other criminals attacked him as well, which is really weird because they're all horrible. But it,
especially like Kenneth Erskine. Like,
yeah, but they're all like, oh, this guy's worse. Let's
he must
get
have been
him.
Irritating. Yeah. He kept stealing their jumpers and wearing them as underwear. Yeah.
So he was attacked again in 1997 by Ian Key, and he loses vision in one eye at this point, so quite lasting effects, and a bunch more times. He did apply for parole when he was old enough, but they said no and that he'd never be released from prison. So I think he's back in normal prison now, but you know, by that point I was so tired of researching I just gave up.
So your homework is find out where he is.
Okay, so thank you for listening.
Thanks very much. Hope you enjoyed it.
Yeah.
And if you didn't, shove it up your book.
And we'd love for you to tweet us and tell us what you thought of it, as long as it's good. And
it's true, though.
Yeah, it's true. Get on Facebook, join in the conversations on there. You can follow us on Instagram. I Google it, like Slaughter, it comes up, Slaughter Podcast. You can email us at slaughterthepodcast@gmail.com, and remember, listening to Slaughter doesn't make you a psycho.
Wearing a jumper as your underwear, I mean, that's just like the itchiness against your very private regions. That alone is a worry.
Yeah, have a good week, guys. Bye
bye.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.